For me, the crux of the problem is, and I only pray I will be proved wrong, that the doomsday clock of climate change is ticking ever faster towards midnight. We are simply not reacting quickly enough. We cannot be anything less than courageous and revolutionary in our approach to tackling climate change. If we are not, the result will most likely be catastrophe for all of us, but with the poorest in our world hit hardest of all.
Well, that was Prince Charles speaking to the European Parliament on February 14th. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. So far, the fight to contain greenhouse gas emissions has been a phony war. All the green talkers in Europe have only increased their carbon load. Canadians like to feel superior to the dumb denial of the Bush administration. But as we'll hear today, a series of green-sounding climate plans in Canada were just window dressing for the ever-increasing greenhouse gas pollution. Today we're going to hear not from a climate scientist, but from a social scientist and an energy expert. He says knowing about human-made climate change is not half the battle. Information, feel-good phrases, and the occasional subsidy of a hybrid car do exactly nothing to save the climate. And we should have known from history, human habits are exceedingly hard to change. Mark Jacquard is telling governments in many parts of the world, the only answers now are the tough ones, compulsory laws with real teeth. We'll let Dr. Jacquard explain how governments fail and yet could succeed in the greenhouse control game. Canada's Professor Mark Jacquard has developed scientific models to study how governments cope with climate challenges. His results are solid and controversial. Just knowing about the climate threat is obviously not enough. As consumers, we know, but just keep on polluting. Some politicians mean well, but we can't seem to get them to change our carbonized society. This talk is about how nice guys finish with a wrecked climate. Professor Mark Jacquard is a much sought-after advisor to many levels of government. Based out of Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada, Jacquard has served on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. For several years, he chaired the BC Utility Commission in charge of the energy supplies for millions. Jacquard is the author of 90 scientific papers and 3 books, including Sustainable Fossil Fuels and his latest, Hot Air, co-authored with famous Canadian journalist Jeffrey Simpson. As one of the few people with real solutions for governments, Jacquard is in constant demand. He has advised the Chinese government, the Canadian government, and worked with other scientists around the world. In addition to a 20-year teaching career at Simon Fraser University, Jacquard has his own consulting company and is also funded by the C.D. Howe Institute. Throughout all this, Mark Jacquard tries to maintain the unbiased stance of science. He is not an environmentalist, a business hack, or a politician. Jacquard has analyzed why climate policies fail and how they could work in any country. This is why we need to learn from his speech, delivered in Vancouver on March 4, 2008, at the Canadian Memorial United Church. The speech was organized by VTAC, Voters Taking Action on Climate Change. It was recorded by Radio EcoShock.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks, Kevin. So this is the first time I've spoken in a church. I'm a little uneasy. So the title says it, and Kevin gave a good introduction. 2 decades of failed climate policies in Canada. And I've had to change my talk, my standard spiel of the last 20 years. So there's a second part, 2 weeks of change. I couldn't find the right word there. Change, hope, revolution. I'm not sure what it is. I am very hopeful, and I'll get to that. But still, the bulk of my talk is about the first part there, because I really need to help people understand what I think the research is telling us. And a lot of that, as Kevin said, is counterintuitive, especially to us in our everyday lives, in terms of how you actually do get greenhouse gas emissions to fall. Now, before I even go into getting into some of the details here, though, I found that it's important even though this issue has been with us for so long, to make sure that people know something about how greenhouse gas emissions would go down and how policies would make that happen. So what are the actions that reduce greenhouse gas emissions? Well, it's really simple. In cases where you're using fossil fuels, it's energy efficiency. Or it's fuel switching, switching away from energy. So I'm going to use less energy, fossil fuels. I'm going to switch away to renewables of various kinds or nuclear. Or it's pollution control, which we've done before with fossil fuels. I'm going to capture the carbon and not let it go into the atmosphere. Now, those are the three basic actions that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I have a fourth, which I'll call a catch-all, because it turns out there are other emissions that aren't just related to fossil fuels, to the carbon that comes out of the carbon in coal, oil, and natural gas and gets into the atmosphere as CO2. There are also methane and other emissions from a couple of industrial sectors, which also have CO2 associated, cement and aluminum, and also some emissions from agriculture practices and forestry. And all of these are more difficult and challenging to get at. And so a lot of times, and I'm going to do that tonight too, some of us sort of leave those off to the side. Of course, I work on that in that area as well, but in a public talk like this, I'm really going to probably focus on those first three actions: efficiency, fuel switching, pollution control. Now, politicians will come out and say, oh, we're going to do more efficiency, or we're going to have more windmills, or we're going to do more of this or more of that. But in fact, politicians don't do that. Businesses do that, and we do that as consumers, as households, as individuals. And so governments, all they have are some levers, policies, that try to get us to change our actions. And that's important because that therein lies one of the sources of failure and problem right there. The political process, surprise, surprise, is not perfect. It's got all sorts of failures associated with it, and I need to explain some of those because that's why that'll help to understand why policies might not work. What are the policies, though? And I'm going to, again, try to keep this really simple. I gave you, like, four actions. I'll give you four policies. They are information programs. We try to inform people so that you might do something for moral reasons, take one of those actions. Or you might do it for economic reasons. We've convinced you that energy efficiency will save you money, getting a more efficient fridge or a hybrid car. So information alone has driven you to buy something, to do something different than you otherwise would have. Or we give you a subsidy. So we've actually changed the financial situation. We give you a subsidy to insulate your home. We give a subsidy to wind power generators. Or we pass a regulation. We say, sorry, manufacturers, as of 5 years from now, you can no longer sell fridges that are this inefficient. You've got to knock out one-third of the product line, the least efficient fridges. There's a regulation, or building codes, or vehicle emission regulations. And finally, there are financial charges, carbon tax, as we talked about, a greenhouse gas tax, some kind of financial penalty. And those are it. So information, subsidies, these command and control regulations, and financial charges. Now, there's a little complication. There are ways of mixing these together in hybrids. And one of them that I'll talk about is what we call market-oriented regulations. So just think of it as regulations, but they have some characteristics that are like a financial tax. And an example would be where we put a cap on emissions, let's say to industrial emitters, and we say to them, so we're going to give you permits for the total amount of emissions, then that's going to decline over time. You're going to have less permits each year into the future so that emissions will go down. But those permits, you can trade among yourselves. And the trading price of those permits, so some of you might do more emission reduction, and therefore have permits to sell to someone for whom it's expensive and they do less. The price of those permits acts like a carbon tax. So that's why people like me, and I'm an environmental economist, an energy economist, I tend to say, well, whether it's a carbon tax or whether it's a cap and trade system, that's a compulsory policy that gets a price out there. And although in the media lately I'm seen or portrayed as the carbon tax advocate, if you read any of my work, I'm not. I'm not a carbon tax advocate. I am a compulsory policy advocate because the research has shown me that the other stuff didn't work. But I don't care if you do it by tax or regulation, but I'll help to explain to you, that's the kind of research I do, what are the implications of these in terms of equity? What happens to low-income people? What happens to the economy and so on? So those are your policy options. So just to back up again, right? We've got the actions that reduce emissions, the policy options. What have we been doing for the last two decades? I think you know where I'm going. Basically, in terms of actions, we focused almost entirely on energy efficiency. And the reason we've done that is because we've thought that energy efficiency was cheap. And the research, as I'm going to explain, suggests that that might not have been right. It seems like it's right, but it might not have been. Also, once we figured out that efficiency was what we wanted to do and that it was cheap, then the policies we favored, well, we didn't need the compulsory policies. You don't need a tax. You don't need a regulation. Just inform people of the money they're going to make by getting a more efficient fridge or a more efficient car. That's all you need to do. Maybe give them a little subsidy. So those first two policies, the non-compulsory ones, that's what we favored. So that's basically been the history of this process. And I'll the example I might give is that most of you are very familiar with, or familiar to some extent, with Canada signing the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, so now over 10 years ago. And after we signed that Kyoto Protocol, we ended up picking a target that was basically the same as the European target. Now, this was really foolish, because our ability to reduce would be very different than theirs, especially because the measurement was from 1990, which is after the East German economy had collapsed and they closed down all these coal plants, and the UK mining industry had been undermined by Margaret Thatcher, and coal plants in England had switched over to natural gas. So the Europeans had all of these reasons why emissions were going down. Plus, they didn't have fossil fuel sectors like Canada and Australia that were very important. They didn't have the population growth that we have. By any measure, the economists like myself who were advising government said, don't do that. But we did. There was a lot of bravado. We can do what the Europeans can do. Then afterwards, the government, Jean Chrétien, said, and we're not going to put a tax on. And we're not, and you know, we'll negotiate some stuff, but we don't need to do that. So what they did do is they hired my group of researchers, and we have a consulting company based downtown that's existed for 20 years. These are former students of mine who run it. We're sort of at the edge of cutting-edge research and applied consulting. They picked our model for a very large project for all of Canada to simulate what would be the effect of policies so that Canada could hit its Kyoto target. We simulated you're going to need a tax, a substantial tax, to get emissions to stop growing and decline in just 13 years between 1997 and 2010. So, and you know, there had been an independent process that had picked our models, run them, said, we like your answers. It went over to the government, and the federal government said, well, we like your line. It shows the emissions hitting the Kyoto target, so we're taking that. But you guys are not that good as modelers and economists and so on, and we know better. So we're going to hit that target. And we're going to use a package here of basically fridge labels and Rick Mercer commercials. And so that's what Canada did for the next few years. Now, I went away infuriated, and that's when I wrote one of my books, The Cost of Climate Policy, where I predicted this is not going to they're just going to keep climbing. That doesn't make me brilliant, by the way. Any of my colleagues internationally laughed, you know, when I explained to them what happened. They said, go write a book, you know, at least then you can say I told you so later on. I was like, okay, that's an idea. So I did that. And so anyway, yeah, they told us we didn't. So that's what happened. It was something called Action Plan 2000. But Action Plan 2000, when we look back in history, is just a blur against all of the policies that we've implemented. So this is another thing I have to educate people about. They often say, oh, we're excited. We've got religion now. Or our politicians tell us that. They're listening to seeing the polls, the opinion polls. So they'll go out and say, we're going to set a target. And in fact, even not that long ago, we had dueling targets among the federal liberals and conservatives. You know, who had the most aggressive target? And So what I've done is put together a graph that shows the different targets that Canada set, because I tried to point out to people, do you know we had a target? Do you know Brian Mulroney set a target in 1988? And we missed that. That was for the year 2000. We missed that long ago. Then we had a target for the year 2005. Do you know about that? Well, we missed that one long ago. And do you know that we implemented all sorts of policies that we said would achieve those targets? So let me just spin down now to the first graph we see. There we go. Now you're not frustrated. You're warned. Okay. Here's the message here. Nice quote from the philosopher George Santayana. Those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. What you see on this graph, and it's from 1990 to 2010, I've got dotted lines there because we don't have the, we actually have the data up to 2005 now, but not for 2000, but the line is about right by most indicators. But what you can see, thanks a lot, Andrea, is that we had targets for the year 2000, those are the things underneath the line. But in every case, we implemented policies, in fact, repeat policies, that we said, that the politicians said, would achieve those targets, would start the emissions going down. And these are color-coded, so you can see that the four liberal policies are neatly bracketed by two conservative policies. So that's Brian Mulroney's Green Plan, which environmentalists gave him an award for, by the way, and the eco-energy policies of the Stephen Harper government at the other end. And then the four liberal policies, each one of which they said, you know, is going to move us on to hitting those kinds of targets. So the message here is, what do we learn from this? And I've already given you lots of hints, but now I'm going to get a little bit more specific. And I want to explain the things that I just told you about actions and policies. Now, with actions, I said to you, energy efficiency is not as cheap as we think it is. And that seems kind of counterintuitive. And there are lots of what I call energy efficiency experts. Well, I call them energy efficiency aficionados, who are, and I was one of them, actually, for my first 10 years as an academic. But as an academic, and I pride myself in trying to look at the best research in the best journals. And we started to get a really nice data set, as we say, because since the 1970s, and some of the people in the audience like me will remember the oil price shocks, from that time forward, governments and even electric utilities implemented various policies to try to make energy efficiency happen. And we were able to measure what was the true cost of some of the energy efficiency. And I have lots of data and studies and you know, leading journals that we've competed over to, and conferences to compare notes, and I'm not going to bore you with all that. I'll tell it a little bit in anecdotes, and my apologies to those who might have heard these anecdotes before. But in my own case, just taking compact fluorescent light bulbs, as a new professor in 1986, I filled my house with compact fluorescent light bulbs because I was an energy efficiency aficionado. I still am, by the way. My house is still full of energy-efficient light bulbs, but I wanted to cost out what this really would be. And I told my grad students, I did the calculations and I showed them these light bulbs will last 10 years each. And in about year 9, the energy savings that I get, so lower bills in electricity, will pay off the capital cost, the higher cost. In those days, they were $30 light bulbs instead of a $1 incandescent light bulb. But anyway, when I was taking them home from the store, I went to look at one just to admire it again. This is new technology. I was excited about it. And I'd forgotten that I'd opened the box from the other end already. And it just, I watched in slow motion as it slid down and broke at my feet. Now, I didn't, so then I ran up to, you know, got the old computer out in those days, what we think of as an old computer, and redid my spreadsheet calculations. And I realized, oh my goodness, it doesn't matter if all the other bulbs last to age 10. I will never pay off this investment. It's done. Now, I didn't tell my students this, you know, because it's first, second year, and I'm still worried about credibility. You don't worry about that now. They know I'm not credible. But then I broke one. The kids broke one, knocked over a lamp. Two others failed really quickly. And I started to look at the research. This is interesting. And of course, it now, in hindsight, is pretty obvious. A long-lived technology that's going to give its payback for you far into the future is a riskier technology. That risk is part of the cost. People know that intuitively. They don't shell out a lot of money for stuff that's going to pay off later on. Energy efficiency aficionados tended to ignore that. The same thing that new technologies, so the more efficient ones tend to be newer, and they're riskier. So I just want to point that out. And it doesn't mean that I'm against energy efficiency. Don't get me wrong. I am as adamant about energy efficiency as I ever was. But if energy efficiency is going to happen, we need to be honest about the economics. We need to be honest about policy. Otherwise, we're just deluding ourselves, and we stay on this path right here that I'm describing for you. A second thing is that technologies aren't perfect substitutes. So those efficient light bulbs had a different kind of hue, and they were not as attractive. And that's the same thing that people in private cars versus public transit. Lots of people really like public transit. I happen to like public transit. When I'm visiting my friends in Toronto, they can't get me off the streetcar. I love those streetcars. When I commuted for 5 years down to the Utilities Commission to my job from New Westminster, I got sicker a lot more because, of course, there were people sneezing on me on the SkyTrain. There are a whole bunch of pros and cons to any means of transportation, and in general, most people probably see a lot of benefits to a private vehicle. That's not something that's going to change tomorrow. We even have an acronym that we use, and apologies to those who've heard it before, for a car in the computer model that we run, and we call it a PMSESICD. To really call it what it is, a car doesn't convey the richness of this device to people. And that means a personal mobility, status enhancing, and sexual insecurity compensatory device. And the research that went into that really has proven itself to be effective. Especially, for example, when we recently had to model the effect of the federal government's transit pass tax credit that they said would shift a lot of people from cars into transit. These can be good policies for a lot of other reasons. I think people who take transit should have cheaper transit fares. For me, that's an equity issue. But I know that it's not going to have much of an effect, at least in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and we shouldn't fool ourselves on that. There are other bigger issues of energy efficiency, and I can't take a lot of time on this, but there's a rebound effect. If things are more efficient, you may use them more. There's a productivity effect. If we make fridges, their compressors and their insulation more effective and help to lower the cost of building and operating fridges, efficient ones, we are part of the process of helping to encourage the development of water coolers, wine coolers, desktop fridges. It goes on and on. I have a very long list of devices that are now out there being marketed. So let me back up now. That was the more university professor part of the talk, and if you're still awake, we're looking good here. So we have about 30 years of evidence, and I want to point out that Al Gore and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change got a Nobel Peace Prize for pointing out the inconvenient truth about our human effects on climate. But also the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was full of social scientists like myself. And that's what I call the second inconvenient truth, that energy efficiency is more expensive than we realize, that information programs have not had much of an effect, and that subsidies have not had much of an effect. And now I need to explain that second part of it. So I'm moving from what was the cost and the effect of this action, energy efficiency, and what was the policies that we used. So as I mentioned before, if energy efficiency is not as expensive as we think, well, then let's get information programs and subsidies. And that's basically what we've done, right? The Rick Mercer commercials and so on, and labels. Now, you have to think about those kinds of information programs competing with the media today in a market economy where advertising is trying to encourage you to acquire the next gadget. There's the challenge for information programs alone. And what about with subsidies? Well, with subsidies, what's important to, this is the hardest one to teach people because And I've said this with politicians. The politicians will say to me, subsidies are great. I love subsidies. I give the person $50. I know they're buying an efficient fridge. I know I've made the world more efficient. And they smile when I give them the $50. And I got the money from just general taxpayers who didn't really notice. This was wonderful. Now, can you ask for a better policy and we're making the world better? And I have to explain to them, well, the research is indicating that devices in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s were always getting more efficient. That doesn't mean that fridges were using less electricity in the 60s as compared to the 50s, or in the 70s as compared to the 60s, because fridges were getting larger, we were getting more fridges, and so the actual use of energy from fridges was going up, while efficiency was improving. Now, when we run the policy, we're actually trying to take that improved efficiency over the decades and make it even steeper. We need to find the people who were going to buy inefficient devices and give them a subsidy to buy an efficient device. And how do we find them? So I'd have to go into a room like this and say, okay, everyone here, now, please, if you were going to buy an efficient fridge, I'm going to be giving out $50 to everyone who was going to be buying an inefficient fridge. So please don't raise your hand, raise your hand if you were going to buy an efficient fridge anyway, so I know not to give you the $50. Now, maybe that would work in a church. I don't know. But I'm not so sure there either. So anyway, that's the problem. And with subsidy programs, we can't give money for every little product people are buying. I mean, it seems every time I go outside to some event, I discover something new. I was at my daughter's soccer game on Sunday, and someone had a portable heater beside them. It was burning propane, and it was right beside them on the sideline. So, I mean, they were getting, 1/50th of the heat off that thing, and the rest of it was just going up like that, and it was burning a fossil fuel. And people are inventing, of course we know the patio heaters, but there's roof de-icers and driveway de-icers, and human ingenuity will find ways to use energy. And to be honest, one day I myself will probably buy that massage chair I always wanted to get. So it's all of us. So there's the problem with subsidy. Now I think so our evidence suggests that much of the subsidy goes to what we call free riders, or perhaps 25% of it, or 50% of it, depending on it. In that transit pass tax credit, it's probably about 98% of it goes to free riders. Then there are these direct rebounds that I talked about, using more of a device, and there's even productivity rebounds where I said we'll invent a whole bunch of other devices. Those things all happen. Okay, so what are the lessons of this? Can I move us on? The big policy lesson. Non-compulsory policies are not a substitute for compulsory. So remember when I said the federal government says, oh, we like your modeling and everything, and we'll take your emission line, but we've got better policies. We're going to use information and subsidies, and that's how we're going to get there. And the lesson of the last two decades is we have to have compulsory policies. And that's the message that I'm bringing as a researcher, as a social scientist, along with my colleagues who are political scientists, economists like me, sociologists, and so on. That's the main lesson that we're bringing. That's what people can accuse me of if they want to. Among those three options of compulsory policies, there's those regulations I talked about, there are taxes, and there are various kinds of market-oriented regulations. And I do a lot of research on actually the non-tax options, because those are the ones that are quite tricky to design. And so we try to do that to help out governments. Now, and let me just give you a couple of examples of this. So people will say to me, although I don't hear as much of it, but I heard a lot of this 10 years ago and 15 years ago. They said, look, we can all just take action on our own. Like we're going to form community organizations and we as individuals voluntarily move on this thing. And I like that sentiment, and I believe in that sentiment, although that sentiment, I have found, is dangerous. If it plays into the people who don't want to act and want to avoid the compulsory policies. And so that's when it gets dangerous. And let me give you an example. This would be like, when people say to me, well, we're going to all share the value that we need to save the atmosphere, we need to care for the atmosphere, we need to care for this earth. That is how we save the earth. And I think that is how we get the right policies. And let me go to that example. Speeding in school zones. For heaven's sakes, if I went around this room, I would find that, I hope, in a church, that everyone would agree that we shouldn't speed in our cars in school zones. We should go at a very slow speed. And most of us, you know, would want to try to follow that. So why in the heck do we have compulsory policies for speeding in school zones? Why do we have financial charges? We make you pay a fine if you speed. And if you're caught several times, we have a regulatory policy. We suspend your license. So there's an example where even though we share these values and they seem very dear and immediate to us, it isn't about worrying about two generations away or people in Bangladesh getting flooded, perhaps, from some action we take. It's really endangering the lives of a young person in our immediate community. And still, we have compulsory policies. So to me, that's a strong case.
Radio EcoShock will be right back after 30 seconds for station identification. You are listening to Professor Mark Jacquard on 20 years of failure of government policy to control climate change gases and his hopes for new programs that will really work. This speech in Vancouver, Canada was presented by VTAC, Voters Taking Action on Climate Change.
The second thing I want to point out to people is I'll often hear, we've got to get behavioral change. And again, let me say, I'm a great advocate of behavioral change. But let's be realistic here. Christianity has been trying to get us to love thy neighbor for 2,000 years and to give away all our wealth, not acquire things anymore. So it's made some progress, but at the same time, it's pretty hard to change people's behaviors. And what are the behaviors that cause more energy use? It's a desire for mobility. It's a desire for things, even to give as gifts to others. It's a desire for comfort, for entertainment, for leisure. Those are some pretty fundamental desires that human beings have. So when people say to me, we've got to have behavioral change, I'll say to them, that acid emissions have gone down dramatically. We used to worry about acid rain. They've gone down dramatically. Please tell me what changes you made in your lifestyle for acid emissions to go down. What exactly have you been doing differently? Lead doesn't come out of the tailpipe of your car anymore. What are you doing differently? Nitrous oxide emissions from your car are at 4% of the levels they were just 2 decades ago. What are you doing differently? And so I have one other graph to show you here. For example, just taking the sulfur dioxide, that's the blue line, which starts up on the left at about 4.5 million tons a year and is down around 2 million tons a year in 2005. And there's an example. What did you do to change those SOx emissions? I have some other implications here, but I'm going to leave these and bring them up in question period if you ask me. One of them is I'm going to ask, what about offsets? Because you would have heard that language now. It's like, I'm emitting greenhouse gases, so I'll put some money into offsets. Well, with apologies to people who may have been working very hard to set up offset organizations and corporations, I see a real mixed blessing to that kind of activity. Because on the one hand, again, it can give us the sense that, there's things that we can do voluntarily, and government can say, good, go and do that stuff. We don't need to put in the compulsory policies. And secondly, what is an offset? An offset, instead of being a subsidy from government to someone, is a subsidy from an individual to another individual, or a corporation to another individual. So it still has all the same problems with subsidy that I just described to you. We have to try to make sure that the money we give to someone will make something different happen. They will behave differently than they otherwise would have behaved. And how can you be sure of that? And it's not to do with any deviousness on the people who are doing it. It's like, I am going to go and buy a more efficient device. Yes, we need to find someone who wasn't going to buy a more efficient device. And how do we find that person? So those are the challenges with offsets. And an example of this is an offset program from the Kyoto Protocol is called the Clean Development Mechanism. And some people might have heard of that. Well, some colleagues of mine at Stanford University in San Francisco have just recently been looking at the Clean Development Mechanism, which is an offset or a subsidy program from the countries that have emission reductions requirements under Kyoto to enterprises or people in countries that don't have these requirements. About half of these are going to China, and a significant amount now are going, for example, to small hydro projects. And so here's the data set, and it really picked up in just the last couple of years. Here's the data set. We were just as the latest data set put together and by my colleagues small hydro capacity additions in China. Now, the blue, so these are in gigawatts. That's 10,000 megawatts. So 10 gigawatts is like the British Columbia hydropower system, our electricity system today. So that's like a British Columbia getting implemented in small hydro in China in 2004 and again in 2005. And in 2006, if you see the purple square there, that's the hydro project that got financial benefits, got the offset payments through the Clean Development Mechanism. And but the total number doesn't go up, so that's just a percentage of that blue box that you're seeing in 2006. What you're seeing in 2007 is that all of the blue box is at least covered by the purple box. It means that every small hydro project in China got money from the Clean Development Mechanism, even though the total number of projects in China is about a flat line. So you see what's happening? An offset program is coming in. Everybody there is not keeping their hand, or they're raising their hand and asking for some of that money, and they're getting it. And what's even funny there is that in some cases, this money goes to projects that don't even get built. And that's why the purple line is taller than the blue line. So there's even money going for projects that didn't get finished or for whatever reason are not done. So I hate to give that kind of news. People want to do something. They're thinking, I feel guilty getting on an airplane. What can I do? I'm going to suggest, and I wasn't put up to this by Kevin, but you're better off to put that money into some kind of organization, grassroots organization, whatever, or put in your own time to something that is pressuring the government for compulsory policies. Your own letter writing, your own, again, donations to an organization like this. And so, yes, I can say that Kevin did not put me up to this, but I've been trying to think, what do I do when I tell people the offset one is really problematic? It also means that justifications of carbon neutrality are also problematic, because people are saying, oh, well, I'm going to go, I can still build the coal plant because I'm going to plant the tree over here, or I'm going to do this over here. It's really looking like we have to do all of these things. And so I can explain this more if people ask, but carbon neutrality, because of the problem with offsets in particular, is just as problematic. So I want to talk now, and then I'm turning to British Columbia and my final comments, and so probably about 10 more minutes to finish. I want to talk about what were the political reasons for that failure. And that's really important, because that's going to lead me to say that what just happened in British Columbia was an extremely rare event, and that we're kind of blessed by it and lucky, and it can be wiped away very easily. And so it's something to be defended, and I'll explain why. So in the book Hot Air, we explore a fair bit why this 20 years of policy failure. And this is where I rely a lot. I'm an economist, but I rely a lot on my colleagues. One excellent colleague out at UBC, Catherine Harrison, but they're around the world, who do research on why public policies achieve goals or don't achieve goals. And it's really not my area of expertise. But looking in Canada, and the book I wrote with Jeffrey Simpson of the Globe and Mail, who's someone who's very astute about Canadian politics, and that's one reason I teamed up with him, also to write a more exciting book after people told me that my previous book, Sustainable Fossil Fuels, well, some people at least said It helped them with insomnia and so on. So I'm an academic writer, and so I teamed up with Jeffrey. Now, when it came to things like businesses, I think people are all pretty familiar that they've had a real inconsistent message to government, and they haven't had any trouble about giving that inconsistent message. On the one hand, they've said, oh, we can do it without policy. You know, we're already doing it. And then there's huge lists of, here's how green our business is, and here's what we're doing. So we just, the greenness of business. And at the same time, they've been saying to governments, don't do much, don't tax us, don't put a regulation in, because there's going to be economic cost, there's going to be trade implications, job loss, it's going to be on your head. And that's a pretty scary thing. So that's it's a nice kind of message for politicians, right? It's like, don't worry, we're taking care of it, and don't put in any of these forceful policies, because it'll be on your head, and there'll be great devastation. So this is this big inconsistency again. I believe that reducing greenhouse gas emissions is actually quite expensive, right? And you can see that by what I said about energy efficiency. I still believe it's worth it. So we got to try to figure out how to get policies in that are obviously not going to hammer our economy right away, but are going to get this signal so that we're transforming technologies. Maybe changing behavior a little bit too. I don't know how people will respond. The evidence suggests, though, that more likely they'll start moving towards zero emission kinds of technologies and low emission technologies, and they'll change their behavior maybe a little bit. But we need to get that happening. And with the business message, that wasn't going to happen. What were the environmentalists saying? Well, the environmentalists were by and large on that message that I'm talking about with, energy efficiency is free or pretty cheap. It's pretty cheap to protect the environment, and that's the message that we got. So imagine me being in the room with the cabinet minister, and I'm giving you real stories here, where I'm saying to the cabinet minister, you got to put on a tax, or you got to put on a regulation. And the environmentalist is saying, it's really cheap to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. You know, it's cheap. You go for it. People will acquire those efficient devices. You know, get the word out. So the environmentalist doesn't say don't put in the tax, but they keep telling the politicians don't, you know, it can. So the politician says, I'll tell you what, you know, we won't do the tax thing right now. We'll do another study group on that. And, you know, we'll get out the advertising and the labels and so on. There's your story for 20 years. So the politicians, this is really a file where it's very tempting and easy for a politician to be, what can I say, dishonest, maybe for a politician to just let this one go nicely and not really do anything that makes a difference. A series, as you could see from that earlier line of mine, it's only now, after 20 years, when people like myself are starting to put out this line to show emissions and policies, they're not working. It took a long time for that. It was easy for Jean Chrétien to say, I can get the emissions down without putting a tax on, and Brian Mulroney to say the same thing. Fortunately now, it's getting more difficult for people to say that, but it was easy to say it earlier. It's also easy, for the reasons I just said, for a politician to take the non-compulsory path and get the media and get public support, because the environmentalists are saying we can do it, and business is saying that's the best way to go, and so on. And then finally, it's a global problem, which means you have to take some initiative on your own to act on this. Not everyone's going to act simultaneously. And so it's always easy to say, well, we're waiting for the Chinese to act, or the Americans, or whatever. So there's just a lot of reasons why policy in this field will fail. So I'll leave it at that. I have some other slides, because even recently, the federal government, the conservative government has said, we're going to do better than the liberals. We're going to have some compulsory type policies. You can actually design policies so they look compulsory, and they're not. And so, for example, the conservatives have a cap on emissions, which I was talking about as a potentially effective policy. They've made it intensity-based, which means it's per unit of economic output. So if the economic output grows fast enough, the emissions would still go up. Or even if it grows at all, the emissions aren't going to fall as much as you'd hoped. And then they've said, they only applied it to industry, so the rest of Canadians are off the hook. So they said, how will we deal with the rest of Canadians? Oh, we'll tell industry that 100% of what you need to achieve in this so-called cap and trade system can be by purchasing offsets from residential consumers and households. So you can pay me to plant a tree in my yard, or pay me to get a more efficient fridge, and so on. Ergo, all the same problems that I just talked about policy failure. So And that's basically, so I have a graph for that, but I can show you that the federal conservative policies aren't going to hit the 20% reduction by 2020 target that they've been talking about. Now, what about those compulsory policy options? Just to reiterate, there's the carbon tax, there's some kind of cap and trade that I just talked about, there's regulations like building codes and vehicle standards and so on. There's also something that I've studied a fair bit. I call it niche market regulations. I won't talk a lot about that, but you're welcome to ask about it. Just to give you an example, in 1990, the California Air Resources Board, and that's one of the regulatory agencies that Arnold Schwarzenegger has said, okay, put in regulations to achieve the emission reduction targets that I have. Well, the California Air Resources Board said to the automobile industry, this is 1990, and by the year 1998, we want a certain percentage of the vehicles you sell to be zero emission. So that's going to be like an electric car, maybe hydrogen fuel cell. A certain percentage to be ultra low emission, and then a certain percentage low emission. And then that's going to be a larger percentage in 2003 and 2008 and so on. Now the automobile industry sued them, lost several times. And that policy, and even industry executives will admit that to me, was the big driver for the great innovations we've had in hybrid cars and moving towards plug-in hybrid cars and perhaps eventually hydrogen fuel cell cars and some of the advances in biofuel cars. So those are the kind of policy instruments. I don't have a preference for one or the other. I will say, though, if people ask me, okay, we've got these objectives, right? So people will say, well, we don't like a carbon tax because that's inequitable. I do have to point out, actually, carbon tax is the one policy that you can make sure is not inequitable because you get this revenue, so you can target it to low-income people. On the other policies, you regulate and force people to start acquiring these low-emission technologies, and so poor people are in the same boat. The people will also ask me, well, so, but I'm still willing to do the regulatory stuff, and I try to design, a lot of my work is how to design regulations so they're as close to the carbon tax in terms of equity, as close to the carbon tax in terms of efficiency, because the carbon tax gets the same price everywhere. You can't put regulations on everything. New products are being designed all the time. You know, try to figure out what kind of agency you'd have to create to be regulating the next invention of backyard patio heaters or outdoor heaters that people are inventing and so on. We're talking about a very heavy bureaucratic weight on our economy, so I have to point that out to people. But if they really want to go a regulatory route, I'll do my best to design it in a way that's quite as efficient as possible, as equitable as possible. I'm not wedded to any one of those options. I think the big message from me to you tonight is we have to have compulsory policies. Now, what's happened in British Columbia? What's happened in British Columbia in the last year and in the last 2 weeks? And what's happened is quite fantastic, and I think we don't even recognize it. I have been part in our electricity sector, and the electricity sector is going to be the area in the world where we get greenhouse gas emissions down, one of the areas most quickly and most cheaply. It doesn't seem like it now, because the Chinese are building all these coal plants, but the money on investment and research is saying, how can we retrofit those coal plants to capture the carbon dioxide? And in jurisdictions that have a wealth of perhaps small hydro resources as we have, or wind resources as Quebec has, or biomass resources, there are a lot of ways to make electricity from clean sources. And nonetheless, British Columbia was still futzing about with, well, 50% of our new electricity will come from clean sources, but the other 50% will leave up in the air. We were struggling, and VTACC was struggling a year ago to try to stop two coal plants from being built in British Columbia. What happened was, I mean, my hope was that I was arguing for what I call a 100% clean electricity policy. My hope really was just that they would cancel those two plants. What we got a year ago was a policy in British Columbia for 90% clean energy of our new energy sources, which effectively knocks out those kinds of large plants. Oh, and it said any coal plants that would be built would have to be zero emission plants. They'd have to capture their carbon. That policy, when I look around, is the most radical policy in the world when it comes to the electricity sector. And we haven't even been talking about that. Early in this year, the government came out with a very ambitious transit policy. They put funding towards that. There still are more things to do and more funds to bring together on that. I still want to note that because I think that's a very important part of all of this. And then obviously what just happened in the last budget, and I'll give you a very quick summary because not everyone might know all the details. The government brought in a carbon tax. The tax this July 1st will be $10 per ton of CO2. $50 per ton of CO2 is like adding 12 cents a liter of gasoline. So this one would add, say, 2.5 cents, something like that. It would go up by $5 per year to the year 2012 and be at $30 per ton of CO2. That's a fairly significant value when you look around the world. Now, it should still have a message to it, and the government's working on that, to say, and after 2012, that's got to keep rising. So that's part of, in my view, an intelligent policy. What to do with the revenue? It's 100% recycled. Some of it in a lump sum payment, $100 rebate. Some of it in a tax credit for low-income people. That'll be $100 per adult and $30 per child. Also, lower income taxes by 5% in 2009. Lower corporate income taxes from 12% down to 10% over a three-year period. And provincial sales tax reductions or eliminations on all sorts of devices, again, that would be lower emission. The government also is working right now for later in this year on regulations for vehicles, vehicle emissions, building efficiency standards and emission regulations, and perhaps fuel carbon content regulations to mesh with this as the whole package of compulsory policies. And again, just recently, someone from the UK who's sort of the lead person in policy there, Michael Grubb, happened to be here visiting a colleague on Sunday night. So I sat down with him and compared it to the United Kingdom climate levy. Our climate levy is better than theirs. It's more aggressive for reducing emissions. I'm comparing it right now to the ones in Norway, Germany, and Sweden, and it's looking like it's better than those. It could very well be, and I don't want to say that just yet, that we have the most aggressive greenhouse gas policies in the world right now here in British Columbia. But don't quote me on that. I'm still looking in detail. Some of these other policies are quite complicated. The Norwegian system with various exemptions and so on. And that's another thing. Our provincial government brought this in basically without exemptions. Because they were doing it in secret, they couldn't work out some of those fugitive kinds of emissions in cement and aluminum, but they're telling the industry the tax is coming on those. We're just going to have to work that out now. But otherwise, when I compare this to other countries with all sorts of little loopholes and so on, that's just part of the normal negotiations, they didn't do that. They brought in a very clean policy, which I also think is very important. So what have we got? And I'm just finishing up now. We've got, as I said, it's very easy for politicians not to be honest on this file, to sort of tell you that we're doing something, and it fools everyone, because it's like, oh, they're going to give some more money. And in fact, I've even heard the opposition saying, and I've heard environmentalists saying, how much money did you put in the budget for this? It's not a question of how much money you put in the budget for this. You can make the subsidies. I've run scenarios of very large subsidies, and we still don't get there. In this case, we've gotten honesty. It also takes courage. You're not going to be popular, in North America especially, putting on a tax. The media coverage has almost, I'm saying to the media, let me get out there and write some articles where we do case studies about how people's taxes are going down. What are the implications for low-income people and so on? I still haven't even calculated all of this, but I know the people in finance that I've interacted with were doing some calculations, and they're telling me this is good news for low-income people. Well, I can't confirm that yet, but the media is just not interested in that as far as I can tell. They're mostly interested in the tax increase. What's going to happen driving your car? What I try to point out is that a carbon tax like this really has its bite 20 years down the road. So it's our children. If our children are dumb enough to still be buying gasoline Hummers and driving them a lot, when there are all these other options that are emerging right now, hybrid cars, plug-in hybrid, biofuel, eventually hydrogen fuel cell perhaps, electric cars, there are, you know, if our children are still buying the gasoline car, they'll pay for it. But it's not us who's going to pay very much on this kind of scenario. And finally, vision. And that's that whole bit about you've got to give this signal about where we're heading. That's what creates a business case, both for industry, when they're making investment decisions. They don't just look at, oh, it's $10 in 2008. I've heard some people carping about that. It's too low. It's a trajectory going up high. And that's the only thing you can do if you're trying not to kill your economy at the same time. Let the people who say it should be at $40 today try to get elected somewhere in a democracy. So we are making trade-offs, but this one is still aggressive, and I'm very excited about it. So, yeah, the critique, and I'm going to end off here. I call it the Goldilocks critique. The tax is too small or the tax is too big. The tax is too small, it won't cause behavioral change. I've read that several times. Well, you've already heard my point on behavioral change. We're trying to change the economics for the evolution of technologies. And if behavioral change comes along, great. And if you want to encourage behavioral change for a whole bunch of other reasons, to make people's lives better, and it's a good thing to do, great. But I don't want to wait for behavioral change, because in the next two or three decades, we've got to make real progress on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. That's what the scientists are telling us. And then, of course, the tax is too big. It's going to hurt low-income people. It's going to hurt rural people. I'm running numbers on this right now. I've already told you about the low-income, my guess. And my guess on rural, it's interesting, when I chaired the BC Utilities Commission, I found out that rural people don't necessarily, on average, drive more than people in Vancouver when we add in our long-distance commuters in and out of the city. That rural people also, because their houses are better insulated, their energy use per year was very close to the same. So I'm not. All I'm saying, fine, from a political point of view and perception, if we need to do more in the rural areas, I would tell a politician, go ahead and do that, because politics is also about perception. But I'm not convinced yet, I want to keep looking, that this is going to have that big negative impact that people talked about. So what do we need going forward? We need a few strategic regulations that I talked about. We need this policy package to be contingent on what's going on elsewhere. We need to try to integrate it with other things in Canada, the U.S., and around the world. I'm thinking of a quote from, so there's lots to do. I'm thinking of a quote from Winston Churchill at some point in the Second World War. I think it was about 1942, and I think just after Stalingrad or something like that, when the German thrusts had been slowed down, and Churchill said, "This is not the end. This is not the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning." And that's sort of how I feel. I feel in myself, my 20 years of my career, trying to get some compulsory policies out here, they're out there now. I feel really desperate to try to consolidate these. I think all of us have to work very hard to make sure that happens. A finance minister can retire as she intends to do in the very near future, and a premier can suddenly decide not to run. And so, you know, I've been listening to the NDP in opposition, and I have not been impressed. This is a time for politicians not to play politics and to get behind this and say, we support this thing, let's make it happen. We'll argue about the government in other areas at some other time. As I say, this is a time when, for me at least, I'm feeling pretty proud to be a British Columbian, but there's a lot of work ahead of us. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Mark Jacquard, spelled J-A-C-C-A-R-D. He heads the School of Resource and Environmental Management at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. Jacquard has advised many governments, including China and Canada. He is the author of more than 90 scientific papers, as well as the books Sustainable Fossil Fuels and, more recently, Hot Air. This speech was recorded in Vancouver on March 4, 2008, by Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. If you missed last week's special on the latest science of the ocean, grab it at our website, ecoshock.org. You can also receive this program automatically as a podcast or download more great green audio from around the world. No ads, nothing to sell at ecoshock.org. Our music today was from the Montreal artist Sylvanus from his album Talking to Jah.
woman have the link. If it was for them, would all be extinct. The balance of life would be resting on the brink. Them rock up there, equally with food. Don't deliver this, young man, don't be rude. So this mama hurt, no excuse. With a goddess by my side, how can I lose? All right then, woman of the goddess of the earth.